Griff and Chuck Coffey interviewing Hyman Richmond for the National Council of Jewish Women's Oral History. Hyman, would you give your full name and address?
It's Hyman Richmond, H-Y-M-A-N-R-I-C-H-M-A-N. I live at 3 Bayard Road, apartment 61. That's over in Shadyside, Pittsburgh 15213. Yeah.
Okay. May I call you Hi?
Sure, please.
Okay. Hi, tell us something about your immediate family, your father, mother, brothers, and sisters.
Well, my parents came over from Europe in, I think, 1906. I associated with the general unrest there, the time of pogroms, and the dislocation of the 1905 revolution, the Russo-Japanese War. This was a time when literally millions of Jews fled from that area. It was an area that I guess today would be defined as the Ukraine, but was always shifting. At times it would have been part of Poland, part of Russia, an independent country of Ukraine. In fact, one of my father's stories relating to that was that one day a man came home and his wife said, "Darling, we have wonderful news. As of this morning, we are no longer under the Tsar of Russia. We are under the King of Poland." And he said, "Thank God, I couldn't stand those Russian winters." So there was confusion as to the area from which they came, but my hunch is that it was that. I also have a strong hunch that in the European Jewish tradition, it was an arranged marriage, which wasn't necessarily all bad, because I guess many of those marriages were arranged at the time. They came here and came to Pittsburgh because my father's brother-in-law, who interestingly enough had the same name, Sam Richmond, was living here in Etna. Now, I'll never know, and I have a strong suspicion, that Richmond was not the original name, and that per the practice of many customs people, it may have been that when he was looking for a man named Sam Richmond, that's what they put down, because it was kind of unique that his name was Sam Richmond, and so was his brother-in-law's name, that of his brother-in-law, who was from Etna. Interestingly enough, they died within 16 hours of each other and are buried right next to each other at the Workman's Circle Cemetery, and people who go to their graves, to see their graves, sometimes have confusion as to which Sam Richmond is which. My family consists of three sisters beside myself. There was a fourth who was one of a pair of twins and who died in childbirth. My eldest sister was Pearl, who's now deceased. Then my sister Martha, who lives in Massachusetts and is, I think, 77 years old, and is a widow. And then myself, just recently 69. And then my younger sister, who is 66, she lives in Florida now.
Were any of your sisters born in Europe?
No, we were all born here. Interestingly enough, because of the nature of the Hill District, we had a few of the problems that European-born people had, and that was that the neighborhood spoke Yiddish to such a degree that when I had problems with English in kindergarten and first year, first grade, my mother determined that from that point on, English would be the predominant language at home, so that there wouldn't be that kind of handicap at school. But still, Yiddish was spoken, and I think I'm fairly fluent in it.
What other characteristics were there of your home in growing up?
Well, the assumption was, as in, I guess, the characteristic Jewish home, that one could gain in learning and not necessarily climb out of poverty. This is why I'm so pleased with what has happened to the Pittsburgh Jewish community well within my lifetime. Because when I was a kid, it was assumed that you were going to be poor. There would be a handful of people who might climb out. And keep in mind that when we talked about we excluded the earlier settlers who were predominantly German Jews who were associated with Rav Shalom and had nothing to do with our world, that is our day-to-day world. Ironically, I'm a member of Rav Shalom today. But anyway, the assumption was that poverty would continue, but my father had an expression in Yiddish, which I'll translate for you, which said, "Zu sein Olam is nicht kein Schande, aber nicht zu sein ein gelernter und edler Mensch ist ein emissel Schande." Translated, it means there's no shame in being poor, but not being a learned and decent person is the worst sin of all. That you can have in the midst of poverty. The household, to some degree, reflected an almost Hyde Park atmosphere that you had in the Hill District at that time, and that there were constant political discussions, disputations, and so forth. So that when I went to Pitt and took my first economics course, and I was amazed at never having cracked an economics book. I was immediately the star student in the class, even though I barely got out of high school since I was in athletics more than the intellectual end of life. So there was that kind of an atmosphere. The Aaron Kaufman settlement was a very important part of the Hill, more so than I think any other historians have ever noted. For one thing, many of the houses didn't have baths, so just the bathing facilities were something. I think it cost a nickel to go there to get a bath with a towel. If you didn't have that, you didn't pay that. One of the features that I appreciated later on was the so-called milk well, where kids would get their milk during the activities. I think it was a few cents, and I'm sure the large number
would pay. I think we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves.
Perfectly all right. That's what I want you to do.
You speak Yiddish, you speak of Yiddish being spoken in a home, which may be a reflection of religiosity, and it may just be cultural. Was yours a religious home?
No, it was emphatically non-religious, although there were certain cultural aspects that would cut across. For example, I didn't realize that through cultural habit, my mother never cooked on Saturday. We always had cold meals. Friday night was the night that people were home and had dinner together. On the other hand, we did not observe, I never went to Hader, and one of my father's statements once was, that's why I'm saying there were certain mixtures which cut across the religious and non-religious. For example, my father said, "I want you to be a good Jew, so stay out of the synagogues." His point was that the socialist point of view was ethical Judaism without the religious aspects, that is, being decent with other people, caring what happened to them. So that these people, although they were non-religious and anti-religious, never begged the question as to whether or not they were Jews. There was a strong emphasis on Jewish culture, on Yiddish, the Jewish traditions and history, but not associated necessarily with religion. I think that's difficult to understand today when it's been blended pretty much. Instead of going to Hader, I went to a shula, which was a Jewish school conducted at the Labor Lyceum on Miller Street in the Hill District. And we went there every day. Other kids went to Hader, and we went to shula. And it was operated by the Workman's Circle, which was the Jewish fraternal group. The Do you want me to tell you a little bit about the show?
What, do you want to discuss, you talk about ethical behavior, but you seem to stay away from monotheism in the Torah and so forth. Is that a breaking point?
I've never considered it a breaking point. Superficially, it was. In real significance, I never felt there was a breaking point. I felt that coming from different aspects, that is, behavior in the sight of God or behavior in the sight of man, which was really the other, you still wound up with the same answer of how you were to relate to other people, how you were to be responsible for other people. For example, I've been very interested in social movements all my life. I'm on the Community Relations Committee of UJF today, and on the boards of Jewish Family and Children's Service, United Mental Health, and several other things. And this comes out of what I feel is a Jewish cultural experience. Now, it does not at all contradict or conflict with a Jewish religious experience, you say, at all. It's just that is, what is your motivation as to why you do it? Do you do it because it is Torah and part of your religion, or do you do it as an erlich, an ethical person? You wind up with the same answer. And I have no doubt that the roots are the same.
Okay, getting back to your home, were your parents disciplinarians? Or what kind of parents were they?
They were not rigid in that sense. I had a great deal of flexibility, and there was always something which is not uniquely Jewish. In fact, it's just Oriental as it's Jewish, and that is, the term is pasnish. You just don't do certain things, you see. And in the Oriental sense, it's saving face or against family tradition and so forth. So that I never felt a sense of rigidity. There was a concern in caring. Now, there you had something that, because of the long hours worked by people at that time. My dad, when he worked, was working 12 hours a day or so. You had almost a matriarchal home. Mama was the person with whom you had the greatest amount of contact. Papa came home dead tired, he'd eat and lie down, and then maybe have an hour or so with the kids. So that the long work day, to some degree, shaped the relationship of the children to the family.
Now let's extend a little bit to the Hill District, the IKS, which you briefly alluded to, and so forth.
Well, getting back to the settlement, there were a number of activities, and my heavy activity at the settlement, there were two aspects to it. One was that I can't remember when I did not go to the settlement. They had day play school during the summer. You went there every morning, and you'd go home for lunch and go back. And there were all kinds of activities, arts and crafts. And as a matter of fact, Leonard Lee, who is a well-known artist today, was one of the people who worked down there with the kids. They had an excellent art school, all sorts of activities. They had a swimming pool, gymnasium. Ziggy Kahn was the famous coach there, Nadie Kaufman, in swimming. There were the general activities. You'd bring home a raffia, a basket, or something of that sort. That was more or less phase one, which went up until the time I was about 12. When I was about 12, I went for an examination, and a young intern, and obviously a naive one, gave me an examination and said that there was a tubercular predisposition in my left lung, and suggested to my mother that perhaps we should move to Arizona. She looked at him as though he were crazy. We had trouble paying the rent where we were. By that time, I think we might have been beginning to pay to buy a house. He said, alternatively, he suggested some mild sport, perhaps swimming. So at that point, I became active in swimming with Nadie Kaufman. And I guess I worked with things pretty intensively, because I passed my beginner's test in July, And in February, I won the city junior high school swimming championship. So it was an everyday practice kind of thing. And that became my dominant relationship to the settlement from then into college. The same people who swam there also swam for Shenley and for Fifth Avenue. Jack Morris, who is still active in teaching, was a member of our team. I quit just before he began to get better than I was. I swam for Shenley for a while, then went down to Fifth for 1 year. And we won all kinds of championships under the names of the settlement, Fifth Avenue High School, and Shenley High School. As a matter of fact, that was the vehicle for several of us to go to college. There were two Liederstein boys. One of them is now deceased. The other one lives in Paris. Called Norman Tobias. Called Beacon, named Beacon, Al Beacon, who lives in Cleveland, and so forth. So that I went to college in part on a scholarship, swimming scholarship, and in part on a loan from the Settlement House, which had a scholarship loan fund. During the time that I was going to college, I was on the Pitt swimming team right through, and did fairly well. I was not an outstanding star, but I was enough to be a varsity swimmer together with Bob Prince, who was a very good swimmer at the time.
Getting back to the Hill, what was going on the Hill at that time?
Well, many things. It was one of the most exciting places you could imagine. To my knowledge, there was little or no crime. It was absolutely safe on the streets at any hour, in spite of the fact that people were poor, and you would expect some correlation with crime. This I ascribe to the Jewish cultural tradition. Whatever crime there was probably in the area of bootlegging was the biggest crime of all. I remember a family anecdote that tied in with that, because here you had a number of synagogues on the Hill, and there were only two kinds of people who had any money, and those were the professionals who, in short order, generally moved away to East End or Squirrel Hill, where they were on lower, below fourths, never above fourths at that time, or the bootleggers who stayed there because that's where their traffic went on. This created a problem, and one often suspected that one or the other were a candidate to be president of the synagogue, because there was invariably a mortgage that no one could pay except those who had some money. So it was a kind of a COVID compromise. And I still remember my father's serious response when I mentioned that a shoemaker who lived up the block had been elected as president of the synagogue. And he very seriously said, "I didn't know he was a bootlegger." By the way, he was. And he wasn't being funny about it. Many serious things which are funny to us today were said seriously then that told you something. For example, my father was a very active freethinker, a freethinker or atheist. He was once asked in Yiddish whether he was still a freethinker, and his answer was, "I'm still an atheist, thank God." And he wasn't trying to be funny. He was answering in the Jewish tradition that at the end you say, "Thank God," and he found nothing inconsistent about it.
Did your life extend to the city at large?
No, it was very narrow. This is what interests me. I didn't realize how almost provincial the neighborhood-wise was until I began to go to Shenley High School. I lived just about 100 yards inside the Shenley border. That is, Kirkpatrick Street on the Hill is the dividing line between Fifth Avenue High School and Shenley. Now, in my last year, I transferred to Fifth, and I used some pretext. It was really so I could be with the rest of the IKS swimming team that was swimming for Fifth. So I'm an alum of both schools, that's how I know people in both. But I didn't realize that there were nice houses for anyone. or converse, let's put it this way. I didn't realize we were poor because everyone was at the same level. A house, for example, when I was a little kid, we had an outhouse in the back. When I was about 8 or 7, we began to pay for a house up on Webster Avenue. We were originally on Worcester Street. And there we had the inside pump, you see. But there was no sense of poverty or deprivation at all because everyone was in the same boat. When I went to Chinle High School, I would walk by the nicer houses on Upper Center Avenue and realize that there was another kind of a world. While I was at Pitt, when we would travel to other cities, then I began to see this. But interestingly enough, not having a car, dependent on the streetcars, and not having any particular reason to go anywhere else, there was a very provincial kind of approach. We talked about the Oakland kids, which included Belt Rip, whom I didn't meet until I went to Chinle, you see, and the Squirrel Hill kids who were, to our minds, as far away as Denver, that sort of thing.
You mentioned a few friends, league, leaders, teams, and so forth. Are there other friends you'd like to talk about?
Well, many that I know today that were close friends, but primarily associated, I guess, with my swimming days. The others are people I knew, and some of us have grown in the same direction. Max Bluestone, who is very active in Jewish affairs, was a classmate of mine, and we've known each other well. But aside from old sentimental attachments, there aren't many close ones. There'd be a few. Because once you got out of the swimming sport, you no longer had that in common. Now, Norman Tobias is someone who is a good friend of mine, and there's been that parallel. We were swimmers together. He is now in business, and we have certain interests. Interestingly enough, his roots were the same as mine. But he's a devotee of Milton Friedman's economics over on the right, and I'll never get there.
Okay. How about teachers, the school, other influences?
Well,
in your...
I started off at McKelvey School, which was up on Bedford Avenue. Of course, schools were much stronger disciplinarians, but you had a mutual reinforcement between the home and the schools. And that is that at home you were taught that the teachers were always right and you should learn. So there was great mutual support. And if you were ever censured at school, you were doubly censured when you got back home. You were, your homework came first before playing. So I had the feeling that, you know, it's quite a time back, that the teachers were very, very dedicated. Interestingly enough, in doing my mediation work today, I work with teachers, groups, and school boards. I realize how poorly they were paid then. And as a matter of fact, school teachers were not allowed, women were not allowed to marry, so they'd lose their jobs. I still remember, I won't give her name because she's still living, we saw this one teacher walk into a man's house one night, not come out till morning, and we were disappointed years later to find out that they were secretly married. Had she told the school board, she'd have been fired. But these were very dedicated people. I can't recall any by name at that, back to elementary school. In junior and senior high school, there was some outstanding teachers.
Were you always in good health?
Yes, I've been very lucky that way. An appendectomy in 38, I suppose, it knocked me out of one swimming season. I don't know whether I should have had it, but Dr. Frankenstein said that everybody had to have their appendectomy. Everybody had their favorite operation, and that was his. My health has been very good, as my father would say, thank God.
In spite of the tubercular...
Well, I'll never know whether that was so. It might have been a transitional thing. The swimming may have very well taken care of it.
How did you see medical care in those days?
Amazingly, first of all, as I said, There was no basis for comparison because from day one, one went to the clinic at Montefiore. So one had to operate in terms of the how that particular hospital operated. Sitting and waiting a long time was part of it. So if you started that way, you didn't have a basis for comparison. When I go to my doctor now, I'm generally in there within 15 to 20 minutes. Now I realize I waited a long time then. But for my vision, which has always been very poor, Dr. Thornton was my physician and my ophthalmologist at the clinic, and you couldn't buy a better one but on a fee basis, you see. And one didn't have to. I had no need to go that much, you see. But I think that the quality of care was probably excellent. One can question it today, you know, as to whether the physician wants to take the duty, whether you have an intern or someone else. But at that time, you had excellent care.
I'm going to jump to another area.
Please do. I'm glad you're helping to direct it, because this can go all over the line.
Courtship and marriage.
Well, you know, I'm divorced now, so that I tell you the better answer. I did very little dating. I did some dating, but having no money, you would have crushes that might have been might have been realized by inviting someone to a club party. I belonged to a club at the settlement, the A.J. Sunstein Club, named after an earlier philanthropist. In fact, one of his descendants is Fran Balder, whether you know her or not. She was a Sunstein. And he had been one of the contributors to the settlement, and one of the settlement staff suggested that name. We were led by a fellow named Abe Cohen, who was a buyer at Gimbel's and Kaufman's and is now lives at Forward Dwellings. Very dapper guy, and who became a kind of a role model for getting dressed up, because he kind of wore any kind of ragtag clothes, but he came immaculately dressed. He was almost what you'd call a dude. And it was interesting to see the subtle effect on the members. He never required any particular dress. I also was in the Boy Scouts, the Scoutmaster was someone with the name of William Howard Taft Grafner, of the Grafner family, which owned Grafner Brothers. His sister is Alice Grafner, who's active in Jewish affairs. He was brand new out of Culver, and we had an almost military unit in our Boy Scouts. Interestingly enough, the assistant scoutmaster was Joseph Katz.
Are we skirting the issue?
What's that?
Are we skirting the issue of courtship and marriage?
I'm sorry. No, I went off on a tangent. Well, I'm saying that one of the first debates we had in clubs was whether to invite girls.
Okay.
You know, girls were something out there. Sometimes you allow them on your softball team. So there was this gradual awakening with consciousness of girls, voting down motions, whether to have parties with them, and so forth. So I may have gone to a few parties before I went to college, but not very many. Keep in mind that at that time I was crazy about swimming. Couldn't waste time with girls. Had a practice. When I went to college, we had something else which was a bar, and that was at that time very few women went to college as compared with men. So that women were at a great premium, a lot of competition. Secondly, if you limited yourself to Jewish girls, and I just about did, although I would sometimes go out with non-Jewish girls, these were by and large middle-class families. And one of my most crushing experiences, and I won't mention her name because she's around and she's a grandmother, was when I had $2.50, which would have been enough for me to invite a date to a dance with Duke Ellington at the Shenley Hotel, which is now the Shenley Union. And I invited this girl. She accepted, and when she found that we were to go there by streetcar, she said no. She said, and was very, very direct about it. She wasn't going to go with anybody who would take her to a date in a streetcar. It was a crushing experience at that time. Now you can laugh about it. She came from a very wealthy family, and she was married before she was out of college. So you had that kind of relationship. I also met another kind of girl because I was active in the Young Socialists, and I was interested in the rising labor movement of the 30s. One of the people I met at that time in the non-dating area was Father Rice, who was active with labor unions at the time. But there was dating, but almost pro forma. It increased gradually. I was a lifeguard in the summers, which of course made me very much a target for interest by women. But then it would be one of these things that we'd go and have a coke after, which is something of that sort. And there was this gradually increasing interest. Then when I went to work for the Federal Department of Labor, I worked with the state for a year and a half with the relief board. I had an appendectomy, and that knocked me out of college because I couldn't get my swimming scholarship for that year, and there was